Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is with the greatest of pride that I say we have the presence with us virtually of a man of uncommon intelligence, which he has brought to bear with tenacity and courage for decades in connection with the subject matter on which he has specialized and is, I think, really one of the leading scholars in the world, namely what I think of as Sharia supremacism, the teachings of Sharia, the tenets of this authoritative code of Islam, and the jihad that it commands its adherents to engage in. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the director of the Jihad Watch Project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. It can be found at jihadwatch.org. He is also, among other things, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and has published with us Islamophobia and the Threat to Free Speech, one of some 23 books Robert has authored, including the critically acclaimed Did Muhammad Exist? And a book that I'm sure will be critically acclaimed as well, The Critical Quran, coming out in November. It's available for pre-order now. Robert Spencer, it is so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us once again.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Well, there is a lot to talk about. And just sort of reviewing some of your recent posts at PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, and of course at jihadwatch.org, one that caught my eye as a native son of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was something that had otherwise seemingly escaped not only my attention, but that of a great many others, namely a plot to blow up a church in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What was that about, and who was the alleged perpetrator?
Yeah, you know what I think is striking about this right off is how little attention it got. You can imagine if a white supremacist, which of course the intelligence establishment and the Biden administration continues to exist, it continues to insist is the greatest terror threat that America faces today. You can imagine if there'd been a white supremacist plot to blow up a mosque, there'd be huge coverage. But this has gotten virtually no notice. A Muslim, a refugee from Syria named Mustafa Musab al-Awemer, had plotted several years ago to blow up a church in Pittsburgh, the Legacy International Worship Center, which is a Nigerian church, and which he apparently targeted because he considers that somehow Muslims deserve revenge against Nigeria, apparently because Christians are being persecuted there, and he doesn't like the idea that some might be interested in fighting back. In any case, he pled guilty just days ago to trying to blow up this church, and this has floated almost entirely under the radar screen of the international media. That was one perfunctory AP report, and that was about it.
It is stunning, as you say, the contrast in the treatment. And I gather your feeling is that it's a matter simply of the favored narrative versus the unfavored or prohibited narrative that is responsible for this treatment. But it's not just in the media, of course. It is also in the Biden administration, and it's you know, friends and allies on Capitol Hill. But it's deeply troubling, Robert, especially at a moment when we are bringing in tens of thousands of refugees, most of whom we have very little idea who they are, what their backgrounds are, what their purposes may be in our country. So thank you for your reporting on this really under-addressed story. Another one involving immigrants as well, as it happens, long-time immigrants in this case, I think, involves a sect of Islam out of India that most of us have never heard of, the Dawoodi Bora sect. Tell us who these people are, Robert, and what practice are they now accused of engaging in, not just in one place, but apparently sect-wide?
Well, you know, it is, as you noted, a sect out of India, a Sunni sect. They're essentially mainstream Muslims. They're not a heretical sect or one that's considered to be deviant from mainstream Islam in any way by any of the other sects. And that's noteworthy because for years, the media insisted in every case of female genital mutilation that it had nothing whatsoever to do with normative Islam, that it was a cultural practice that non-Muslims also practiced in various areas, and there was no justification for it in any religious text. I can't tell you how many times I read that from establishment media sources. Now we are hearing that the Dawoodi Boras have been practicing it on a nationwide basis in the United States, to say nothing of their home base in India, and that there is a secret network of Dawoodi Bora physicians who practice it under the table, after hours, and so on. And now it's being acknowledged that this is something peculiar to this sect. Unfortunately, there are justifications within the Hadith, the reports about Muhammad's words and deeds, for this practice. And consequently, it's not just a Dawoodi Bora thing either, but this is getting the attention now because there's one physician who is now once again on trial for performing this procedure in Michigan. Federal prosecutors recently revealed that she is just part of this larger network.
This is a case that I followed some time ago, Robert, but frankly lost track of because the federal judge presiding over it seemed so determined to minimize the charges against this doctor and her co-conspirators, I recall, and if possible, sort of wash his hands of the whole thing. But this ups the ante considerably. And as I recall, the leader of this sect in India has made it mandatory that his followers engage in it. Circumcision for boys, as I think he put it, was optional, but cutting the girls was mandatory. And just so we're clear, it's rather unsavory topic, needless to say, but what is done to mutilate the genitals of these children is horrific in the extreme. And the idea that it is permissible in our country, in fact, in the absence of a federal statute prohibiting it, which this judge declared to be unconstitutional on a technical ground, there are some number of states, I've lost track, Robert, maybe you know, but 10 or 12 maybe, that have no laws prohibiting this on their books. So it's actually legal in the United States at the moment to engage in this really barbaric child abuse.
Yeah, that's right. And the problem is that there's a tremendous confusion about the justifications for it. Because even though, as I was discussing a moment ago, we have long heard that this has nothing to do with Islam, which is not quite accurate. There are many Muslims who don't practice it, but unfortunately, those who do have textual justification for what they're doing. Nonetheless, there are others who have insisted, and the judge who threw the case out a few years ago, before it being reintroduced recently, is one of them, that this is a matter of religious freedom. And so America is going to have to decide at some point whether the concept of religious freedom is a license to do essentially anything you want. If you can say that something is a religious practice, then you are freed from other obligations. And so there are laws against assault, there are laws against child abuse, and so on. But apparently, if you can establish that you're dealing with a religious practice, then it's all okay. And this, I think, would be a barbaric retreat from the idea of universal human rights that has prevailed in America up to now, and that we need to resist it. But it's because of confusion over the nature of the freedom of religion in the United States, as if it were a license to break other laws, that this practice has been allowed to proliferate.
Robert, this introduces another subject that I wanted to touch on with you. The Biden administration, President Biden, has nominated to be the next ambassador for international religious freedom, the successor to Ambassador Sam Brownback, who held that role during the Trump years, one Rashid Hussein. former ambassador, special envoy for Barack Obama to a group called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. At the time, President Obama nominated or appointed Rashid Hussein to this post, he declared that he was a Hafiz of the Quran. Remind us what that term refers to, Robert, and what it says about the likely conviction of an individual who is one to embrace and practice, again, what I think of as Sharia supremacism.
Frank, a Hafiz of the Quran is somebody who has memorized the entire thing. And so that indicates that Rashad Hussein is deeply devout, is very serious in its observance of Islam. And if we were able to have a sane conversation, a rational conversation in the public sphere about these issues, then that would raise questions about whether he's the best fit for this job. Because if he's going to be protecting international religious freedom, and yet he believes deeply in the truth of a book that says, fight them until religion is all for Allah, which is chapter 8, verse 39 of the Quran, and mandates that Muslims wage war against and subjugate Jews and Christians under the hegemony of Sharia, which is chapter 9, verse 29, and so on, then one wonders how he's going to regard religious freedom and whether he will see persecution of Christians and denial of rights to Christians and other religious minorities in Muslim countries as violations of religious freedom, or whether he will see that as the natural order of things mandated by the Quran and Sunnah.
Well, and coming back to what we were just talking about a moment ago, whether he would actually regard it as an issue of religious freedom in our country that practitioners of Islam who subscribe to the idea that little girls should have their genitals mutilated in accordance with the hadiths should have the right to do so, despite it violating in many places around the country, and certainly I think are many places around the country the law, and in every place in the country I think the norms and human rights values of the rest of us. This is, it seems to me, a seriously misguided appointment. And I hope that there will be a serious effort to, at a minimum, explore in any hearing on this nomination, which presumably is going to be scheduled soon by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to evaluate whether this individual, in accordance with his deeply held faith tradition, feels that the supremacy of Islam does not translate into tolerance for other faiths, seemingly a very serious disqualifier for the position of ambassador at large for international religious freedom. We turn to one of the other pieces that you had in PJ Media, Robert Spencer, which caught my eye. You talked about the growth in the infrastructure of not just Islam, but of Islamism, if you will, the Sharia supremacism that particularly the Muslim Brotherhood espouses in the United States, using as one bookend 9/11, the other the present moment. Talk a little bit about what has been happening in that space, Robert.
Well, you know, it was kind of ironic, Frank, that in the run-up to the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 jihad attacks, we got inundated with stories in the establishment media about how Muslims have been persecuted in America since then. And there has been a spike in hate crimes against Muslims, and they have faced discrimination and harassment and so on. This was the primary focus of the establishment media in the days surrounding the anniversary. And yet I noted that in one of those stories, a story in Slate magazine, the online magazine, about the difficulties Muslims faced in building a mosque in Tennessee, that there were 1,200 mosques in the United States on 9/11, and 20 years later, there are 3,000. And so it gives the lie to the entire media narrative that Muslims have faced persecution, harassment, discrimination, difficulty. Actually, since 9/11, Muslim population has been proliferating and flourishing in the United States. And so the growth of mosques is an indication of that, but it's also an indication of how busy the Muslim Brotherhood has been. Several different surveys have shown that the vast majority of these mosques are indeed connected to various Brotherhood organizations. The Turkish government, which is working with the Brotherhood, has been underwriting the construction of many of the new mosques over the last few years. And so this is a matter of concern that, once again, we can't speak about in the public discourse, that the Brotherhood wants to impose Sharia and destroy all non-Sharia governments. Do we really know what's being taught in these mosques? And of course, nobody really dares to look.
This is important to note on both the overall sort of top line feature that you've just described, this doubling, more than doubling, in the size of this infrastructure, for want of a better term, in America. But also, Robert, the degree to which the Brotherhood is dominating many of these mosques. And what does that translate into in terms of the pedagogy, in terms of the sermons and the other features of the practice of Islam that is being encouraged inside these mosque complexes?
The Brotherhood is a completely pro-Sharia organization, and it is in favor of the destruction of all governments that do not hold to Sharia, including those in majority Muslim countries that are based on other models for governance aside from Sharia. Consequently, the Brotherhood is something that is going to be preaching Sharia in its mosques, preaching that Sharia is supreme over all what it considers to be man-made law. And that is also a matter of concern, I should say, is the captured internal document that the Center for Security Policy and others have worked so hard to bring public awareness about, where the Brotherhood says that its goal in America is eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within. If you've got Brotherhood mosques and that's the goal of the Brotherhood, then those mosques ought to be under law enforcement scrutiny. But of course, because of the massive intimidation project that the Brotherhood organizations in the U.S. have successfully carried out, that kind of scrutiny is considered to be Islamophobic and is ruled out of bounds.
Robert, just a further point on this, you have written extensively, of course, about not just Sharia, but about jihad. And to what extent does the formulation that's in that explanatory memorandum, as it's called, and it's available, by the way, at our website, securefreedom.org, this document, which was obtained in a raid, as I recall, on a safe house that was unbelievably, fortuitously discovered by accident, really. This document, I think, speaks very clearly, not just to destroying Western civilization from within, but to jihad as the expected means of accomplishing that. And that isn't in the context of personal struggle, is it?
No, this is talking about violent jihad. Let's remember also that Hamas it styles itself to be rather the Muslim Brotherhood for Palestine. And so there are many people in Washington who assume that the Brotherhood is nonviolent and rejects violence because it eschews violence in some contexts. And they make the mistake of thinking that that means that they are moderate, when actually the Brotherhood is committed either by violent or peaceful means, whatever's necessary, to working to impose Sharia wherever possible.
And just for the record, that safe house was in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and part of an archive, we're told, of Muslim Brotherhood documents. It was really quite an extraordinary find. I don't know whether it's been fully exploited. Robert, do you have any sense of that? Whether this document was kind of a one-off, or whether it, you know, is but of a piece with the larger body of work that was uncovered in that trove?
There has been little else released, and the document itself has been the focus of immense controversy, with concerted efforts in the establishment media being made to show that it was not a document of a strategy, but rather just one man's wish list. This has been thoroughly discredited by Kyle Scheidler of the Center and others, in showing that, in the first place, the Justice Department took it quite seriously, even at a time when it was becoming thoroughly politicized, it took this as not just one man's opinions, but as a blueprint for the strategy and goals of the entire Brotherhood movement in the United States. And also, it's worth noting that if you look at the activity of the Council on American Islamic Relations and other groups that are listed as Brotherhood groups in that document, they seem to be pursuing this strategy quite skillfully in working to oppose all counterterror measures, to discredit opposition to Sharia and to jihad, to defame and destroy those who stand up against these things, and to rally the media against them, to make it impossible, really, to do anything effective to resist jihad violence and Sharia oppression for fear of being Islamophobic. If they're not following this strategy, it's a remarkable coincidence, because everything they do is in line with it.
It's no accident, comrade, is what the, the communists used to say, and I think that's certainly true in this case. Not least to your point, Robert, about the degree to which the U.S. government took this document as a serious blueprint for the actions of both the Brotherhood, Hamas, and affiliated entities, and as a, you know, specific agenda of the Holy Land Foundation, a charity that was involved in raising funds for Hamas, was that it helped secure a conviction of five Holy Land Foundation principals, as I recall, for doing just that, and doing so, you know, supporting, in other words, terrorist jihad in our country. And so those were the days. I'm not sure we'd see their like under this Justice Department, that's for sure. But it certainly is something that bears both remembering and reflecting on as we think about this infrastructure being built out and the Brotherhood expanding its influence in the process. Lastly, and very quickly, Robert, I would like to just get your thoughts about the role that Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, two very unabashed promoters of Sharia, Muslims in the United States Congress, are gloating about at the moment, having denied Israel funding for its Iron Dome missile or rocket defense system. Talk a little bit about what these ladies are up to and what it suggests is the state of the Congress at the moment with respect to the self-defense needs of our most important ally in the Middle East, the Jewish state of Israel.
This is a manifestation of the power and the danger of the notorious anti-Israel stances of the squad, as it's called, these four or however many it is now, these radical left congresswomen. They have trafficked for years now, quite famously, in anti-Israel and many would argue anti-Semitic rhetoric, in demonizing Israel and claiming it guilty of various human rights violations and so on. Now, instead of standing up to them and correcting the inaccuracies and falsehoods that they have spread, the Democratic Party establishment, aware that they constitute essentially the Democratic Party's base today, has capitulated to them and accepted their perspective and their agenda. And this vote to deny funding for the Iron Dome is the latest manifestation of how these radical congresswomen are essentially in control of the Democratic Party today. And that bodes very poorly for the Israel-America alliance, because, of course, they are determined to destroy Israel and enable the jihad against it by any means possible.
I think it bodes ill for the United States and its interests more generally in the Middle East and beyond as well. And frankly, for our domestic politics, as this kind of extremism is increasingly, as you say, Robert Spencer, dominating the Democratic Party. Thank you, my friend, for this tour d'horizon, as they say, this comprehensive review of what is afoot, various aspects of the Sharia supremacist movement, the global Islamic movement, as it styles itself, and what it might mean for the rest of us. We appreciate extremely greatly your scholarship and hard work in bringing this information to us all. I know you'll keep it up at jihadwatch.org, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Thank you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock of what we need to do about another mortal threat to this country, the Chinese Communist Party. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say we're back with Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio, and that of, well, much of the free world, I think, on the dangers that we are facing from the Chinese Communist Party. This is a subject about which he has written extensively, notably in several best-selling books, including The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also an essayist of great productivity, notably these days at the Gatestone Institute and Newsweek magazine. You can also find his appearances and his commentary in all the right places, in the cable news networks and, of course, here on this radio program and elsewhere. And we're always delighted to be able to feature him, but most especially today, because I had the privilege of being with Gordon last Saturday for an extraordinary program put on by our mutual friend Debbie Georgiadis, the host of America Can We Talk, in Dallas over the weekend. And we shared a panel, and Gordon spoke at length about something that I really wanted to share with all of you, namely, not simply a critique of the Chinese Communist Party and an analysis of its malign intention towards this country and the danger that that represents to everything we hold dear, but a prescription, a 7-point plan with a couple of auxiliary points thrown in for good measure to actually address, counter, and ultimately defeat the Chinese Communist Party. I found it bracing, thoughtful, and urgently needed. And so we're going to talk with Gordon at some length about it in the course of this interview. And I want to thank you, Gordon, for taking the time to do that. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
The point that seemed to me to jump out from this multi-point plan of yours, Gordon, was a very fundamental principle, which I think it would be hard for anybody, even admirers of China or proponents of its rise, to object to. Talk a little bit about your point about reciprocity.
One fundamental thing that we have failed to do throughout decades is to demand reciprocity from China. So we have allowed China to do things in our country that we are not permitted it to do in China. And there is no reason for this failure of reciprocity. So just to give some examples, China does not allow our media into its country, except in extremely limited circumstances, like hotel rooms in certain hotels. So why do we allow China's media in our country without restriction? You know, China doesn't allow our apps. So why do we allow TikTok and other Chinese apps, especially because Beijing has been using TikTok to influence political opinion and to cause Americans to engage in acts of subversion? I mean, this is just, even without that, Frank, we just, as a matter of reciprocity, just shouldn't allow Chinese apps in our country. You know, we can't have a Reagan Institute in China. So why does China have Confucius Institutes on our college and university campuses? And the same is especially true for the Confucius classrooms in our secondary schools. There are about 500 of those. So just looking at these just several things, it shows that our policy towards China really has been fundamentally flawed in this respect.
So much to say about that, Gordon. I just would observe that if there were such a thing as a Reagan Institute in China, it's unlikely that it would be a government-owned and operated one. And these Confucius Institutes are, of course, in classrooms, let alone that it would be in the business of propagandizing and indoctrinating and perhaps even recruiting people there into our service. It's a world of difference. But another piece that ought to be noted, Gordon, that is totally asymmetrical it seems, is the degree to which the Chinese have sought and obtained access to immense amount of data about Americans, down to, in many cases, it appears, their genetic, you know, makeup. This asymmetry, this non-reciprocal arrangement, has a lot of very serious national security as well as privacy implications, does it not?
Well, it certainly does. Well, China has been vacuuming up the DNA profiles of Americans, and it does that in a number of ways. So, for instance, Chinese-linked companies are accredited to provide DNA sequencing services. So if you go to one of these ancestry businesses, chances are your DNA profile ends up in Beijing. But also there have been these technical cooperation agreements. We've allowed China to buy companies with DNA profiles, most notably Complete Genomics, that a transaction in 2013. Complete Genomics at the time might have had the largest profiles, largest number of profiles of Americans. At the same time, China, by law and by strict administrative enforcement, prevents the transfer of DNA profiles of Chinese out of China. And the reason why this is important is because Chinese military researchers are very open about developing pathogens that will leave the Chinese immune and sicken and kill everybody else. This is what they mean by the phrase, quote, specific ethnic genetic attacks, which is often used by the Chinese military researchers when they discuss this in public.
Really chilling. And again, just a further argument for terminating these non-reciprocal arrangements. Gordon, you've also argued that we ought to be terminating more generally relations with the Chinese, specifically with respect to trade, but also greatly truncating their representation here in the diplomatic sense. Talk about these other aspects of this course adjustment that you're calling for.
The other 6 points in the 7-point plan are severing relations with China. And I know that sounds drastic to many people, but China uses every point of contact with the United States to subvert us. And they're overwhelming American institutions. FBI, local law enforcement, local governments, federal government, we're all being overwhelmed. And until we can be sure that we can withstand this onslaught, we have to sever these links. So, for instance, we shouldn't be trading with China. We shouldn't be investing in Chinese companies. You know, President Trump was great in his last year. He imposed a ban on investment into military-linked Chinese companies, but we need to extend that because all companies, in a sense, are linked to the Chinese military in China because of this doctrine of civil military fusion. So we should be preventing American portfolio investors, state pension funds, all the rest of it from investing in Chinese companies. Again, we need to prevent Chinese companies from acquiring our tech businesses. We shouldn't be allowing technical cooperation agreements. And of course, we should be taking adopting moves to eject China's agents from our society, which means closing down their 4 remaining consulates and stripping the embassy staff down to, you know, instead of thousands in Washington, there should just be the ambassador and his personal staff. And of course, we should stop Chinese nationals from spying on us because Beijing has been using its nationals for that very purpose. So across the board, we need to cut those links.
And of course, Gordon, you would hear among various entities or interest groups in this country howls of protest over all of this, whether it's the diplomats who would not like to see our presence in China greatly reduced, which inevitably would flow from something like what you're describing with respect to their missions here, or whether it's the business interests that rely on Chinese supplies of goods to, you know, fill their shelves, or the capital markets, you know, masters of the universe who are making hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars over their various transactions that they manage that put American pension funds and other savings into, in many cases, some very dubious Chinese companies. What do you say to such people, Gordon, or to those of us who would be regaled by them about the terrible dangers associated with such a truncation, if you will, of relations with the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, the Communist Party has declared the United States to be its enemy in May 2019. People's Daily, which is the most authoritative publication in China, declared a quote-unquote people's war against us. Just last month, on the 29th, People's Daily accused the United States of quote-unquote barbaric acts. And Frank, that's laying the justification for an attack on the United States. We've got to be very clear, because the Chinese have been very clear about how they think about us. So although it is drastic, we have to cut the blood supply of those who believe us to be their enemy. I know that there are no good solutions right now, but that's because we've been pursuing misguided policies for at least two decades, and one could even argue longer than that. So there are no good solutions, Frank. Yes, there will be problems. We will not be as prosperous a society, but we will lose our country if we let things continue, because China has made it very clear that they intend to take away our sovereignty and destroy our republic and end our democracy. We don't have to guess. We just have to listen to what they've been saying.
Interestingly enough, Gordon, I was myself on Breitbart's news program this morning with Alex Marlowe, and he made an interesting observation about President Biden's speech yesterday at the UN General Assembly, to the effect that it sounded as though it could have been written by Xi Jinping, that there was no critical mention of China. There was no holding them to account for what they unleashed on the world with respect to the COVID virus and so on. And I used the occasion to promote my theory, which is that when we hear tell of Joe Biden having two-hour phone conversations back in February and another 90-minute one in past month with Xi Jinping, that he's incapable of maintaining a conversation for that length of time. That's pretty evident. But could these calls basically be dictation by the Chinese Communist Party's ruler? And that's why we are seeing, not just in the rhetoric that Biden is using, but also in the policies that he's following, such a alignment with the desires of the Chinese Communist Party, and to your point, such a growing threat to our sovereignty, our freedoms, and our security.
Biden's UN General Assembly speech was disappointing. Because there were a lot of subtexts that were directed at China, but not once during the speech did he use the word China. And there was this point later on in the speech where he talked about people yearning to be free and actually demonstrating, and he mentioned a number of countries. And it was important that he actually omitted Hong Kong, for instance. I just read I heard the entire speech, and when I read the text, it just struck me that there was a fundamental failure to be able to say the name of our enemy. You can't defend yourself unless you can actually talk about this in candid tones. And, you know, this is, of course, Biden, but it's also been his predecessors have been unable to do this. So, for instance, from Obama going back to George W. Bush, to others, they just were not able to speak about China in realistic terms. And that has made one of the reasons why we're in the predicament that we are in now.
It is indeed. And it brings me to, I think, a final point with you, Gordon Chang, and that is the predicament we're in now is one that features very prominently tremendous losses for American investors in Chinese entities, companies, businesses, investment funds, tutoring sector entities, and so on. Evergrande is the mother of all real estate conglomerates in China, as you know, and has come seriously a cropper I'd be interested in your thoughts as to why and what it means for not just the Chinese economy, but the kind of impact that it has had already on, our Dow Jones averages and the economy of the United States more generally.
On Monday, the Dow Jones average ended down 618 points or 1.8%, but at one point was down over 900 points, largely because of the Evergrande contagion. Evergrande is now the second largest property developer in China, it used to be larger. It has indebted to the tune of about $305 billion. That's about 3% of China's annual gross domestic product, an incredible number. It got that way, Frank, because China has been encouraging debt. They did that to avoid the worst effects of the 2008 downturn, and they were able to do that because they're hiding behind a strong currency wall, that the Chinese renminbi is not convertible on the capital account. And as a practical matter, sometimes is not convertible on the current account either. So China was able to go through one of the biggest increases in debt in history, if not the biggest. And now there's going to be a reckoning. I don't know if Evergrande is China's Lehman Brothers, as many people have said. I don't know if there's going to be a Lehman moment. But one way or another, China cannot get past this debt crisis. It's either going to have the mother of all crashes, or it's going to have a very long period of a lost decade like Japan did in the 1990s. But it will be far worse for China than it is than it was for Japan. This is something we shouldn't be tied to, a country going down the tubes. There are no good scenarios for China. And for us, the only good scenario is delinking from China as fast as we can.
Gordon, I said that might be the last question, but let me just stick one more in here, because you had a very interesting conversation with another radio show host, John Katsimatidis, in New York, I believe last weekend, in which you basically suggested that we're seeing so much news out of China at the moment on a whole host of topics. But what that portends, in your view, is that things are out of control in, the PRC at the moment. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, there's a lot of distressing news out of China these days, especially as Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, pushes his Maoist-style common prosperity plan. You mentioned a few of them just earlier. The point about China, Frank, is that we know less and less about it because it is closing itself off from the rest of the world. But we see a lot of news, and we see a lot of news which draws us to the early days of the Cultural Revolution in 1966. What's occurring in China is not the Cultural Revolution now, but what we're seeing now is the way the Cultural Revolution did start. And that was an abnormal period, maybe the most abnormal period for any country in history. And it started in 1966 and lasted for a decade. China is on a path to either invade its neighbors or to go after the U.S. or to do something. But there's just too much news right now. And that, to me, is chilling.
I'm so glad you mentioned this Cultural Revolution point, Gordon, because one of the other extraordinarily impressive participants in this program that Debbie Georgiadis hosted last Saturday. And I really commend it to all of you. The video of it should be posted shortly, if it isn't up already, at americacanwetalk.org. I believe it's .org, maybe it's .com, maybe it's both. But in any event, check it out, because a woman by the name of Ji Van Fleet spoke about her personal experiences during the Cultural Revolution in China, when her family was badly treated, to say the least, suffered acutely because one of the family members was of the landed class and therefore an enemy of the people, as Mao put it. Her point, Gordon, and let me just ask you to comment briefly on this, if you would. Her point was not simply that Xi Jinping, with his now avowed admiration for Mao may be bringing about conditions akin to the Cultural Revolution and the whirlwind that it reaped inside China, but that we ourselves are now exhibiting behavior similar to that of the Red Guard during the Chinese Communist Party's manufactured crisis known as the Cultural Revolution, Mao's Cultural Revolution, to be specific. Do you see some of those same qualities and characteristics now evident here? And where would that leave us if we allow it to metastasize?
We certainly do see that. And China, actually, through its propaganda organs, is promoting critical race theory. It's raising a number of other racial themes as well. So China is trying to divide the American public by race. And the Cultural Revolution was followed by an attempt to divide the Chinese people by class, as Xu Van Fleet said. Frank, this is China's attempt to destroy the United States. And so we've got to understand what China is trying to do here. And yes, if we did not have a First Amendment, which many young kids, by the way, you know, by surveys, do not support a First Amendment. This is absolutely critical for us because that is the core of the United States. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom to assemble. All of those values are now under unprecedented attack in our own country, and that's being exacerbated by Chinese propaganda.
This, of course, being a central tenet of the race war equivalent of the class war of Mao that's been sort of adapted by the Chinese Communist Party and their friends on the radical left in this country for use in this country. And as you say, Gordon, it is being wielded with devastating effect. I wonder, going back to something you said a moment ago, whether some of this attitude on the part of American young people about the First Amendment and the freedoms that it enshrines, to the extent they know really anything about it, may have been a product of the influence of the Confucius classrooms in our schools, as well as sort of the overarching efforts of sort of the cultural march through the institutions to undermine the central tenets of our country and the values that have bound us as a people behind it all these years. These are the things that, Gordon, again, I find so invaluable about our conversations and your insights and experience with the Chinese, and more generally with the ideology, the doctrine, the agenda of people like Xi Jinping. And we appreciate you informing us about these topics with such faithfulness and such clarity and such courage. And again, folks, I hope that you will check out Gordon's rather more fulsome presentation of his 7 points at the Women for Freedom program that Debbie George Addis put together. America Can We Talk is the website. And also follow Gordon Chang. I failed to mention this at the outset, and I always mean to follow Gordon as I do at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. It is an incredibly rich stream of information, and it helps you keep abreast of what he is doing for all of us to clarify the challenges we're really facing and what we have to do about them. So, Gordon, thank you for that. Thank you again for the prescriptions as to what specifically we need to do. And thank you for your time so generously given to this program week upon week. We'll talk with you again next week. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Affney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The governor of Texas visited the Del Rio sector of his state's border with Mexico yesterday to plead with President Biden to provide the resources necessary to stem what amounts to a debilitating invasion of our country. Unfortunately, Mr. Biden had something else on his mind then, as usual. He was at the United Nations warning about crises facing the planet that require the so-called world community to come together, like climate change and the present and future pandemics. The trouble is that Biden's globalism is not only contributing to the wrecking of our country, including by inviting untold millions of mostly unidentified and unvetted aliens to come here illegally. It fails to appreciate that the only hope for constructive action on virtually any other real problems lies in an America that's economically and militarily secure, a status he's determined to preclude. This is Frank Affney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
I regret I have but one life to lose for my country. These were the last words of American patriot Nathan Hale, who was hanged by the British without a trial this day, September 22, 1776. A Yale graduate and school teacher, he fought in the Siege of Boston and captured a boat full of provisions from under the gun of a British man of war. On Long Island, he penetrated the British line to spy for information, but was captured as he returned. His nephew, Edward Everett Hale, a well-known author, wrote, "We are God's children, you and we have our duties. Thank God I come from men who are not afraid in battle."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.